systems manage to provide the needed care. I'll apologize ahead of time for my voice. I've got an upper respiratory tract infection. Just want to start by thanking all of you for hanging in there till the end of the conference and attending this last symposium. I think we've already heard a lot in the last few days about the importance of collaboration between HIV and TB programs at all levels, from the national level down to the community level. And we have an excellent group of speakers today who will describe their experiences in creating programs at a number of different levels that address the needs of HIV-TB co-infected patients. My name is Adrian Gardner. I'm an infectious disease fellow at Harvard Medical School, and I've worked with the program that in Kenya that you'll be hearing more about. And I'll let my co-chair introduce herself.
My name is Yerusalem Nuguse. I work with WHO Geneva in the HIV department, IMAIT.
So without further ado, our first speaker is Dr. Cisse Sirgu, who comes to us from the HIV-AIDS department at WHO in Geneva. And he's going to be describing his Ethiopian experience with integrated TB-HIV care at the health center level.
Okay, thank you for the introduction. So I will be presenting the challenges and opportunities of implementing TB-HIV care at the health center level in Ethiopia. And I will be presenting this on behalf of WHO Ethiopia Country Office, where I used to work until 4 months back. So my presentation... So this is the overview of my presentation. I will try to present the situations of HIV and TB in Ethiopia and the progress made so far in the implementation of TB-HIV care, with emphasis to primary health care facilities and the challenges and opportunities that exist for the better implementation of TB-HIV activities. So the adult HIV prevalence, as estimated by DHS and ANC Sentinel surveillance, is estimated to be 2.2% for the year 2008. And in relation to TB, the incidence ratio for all forms of TB, as estimated by WHO for 2007, is 349 per 100,000. And smear-positive TB is 152 per 100,000. And this smear-positive TB incidence for the year 2008 is estimated to be 168. And with this, the country ranks seventh among the 22 high TB burden countries. As you see in the picture, it shows the different regional distribution of HIV prevalence. So, as to the TB-HIV collaborative activity implementation, the TB-HIV Advisory Committee was established in 2002. This is the national. And currently, at least similar coordinating committees are established in six of the regions. And there is also a plan to expand these coordinating bodies, establishment of these coordinating bodies at donor and guarded level. And the technical arm of the advisory committee was established in 2008. And TB-HIV implementation guideline initially was developed in 2005, and which was later revised in 2007. And training manual, different training, there used to be different training manuals. After the establishment of the technical working group, there was efforts done to standardize these training manuals, including adaptation of the WHO IMAI TB care with TB-HIV co-management module and training material, which is specifically helpful for the first level facilities. And I will be presenting on the status of TB-HIV activity implementation for the last 7 quarters. So site expansion, so currently there are close to 477 sites which are doing some sort of TB-HIV collaborative activities, some components of. As you can see in this bar chart, it shows the percentage of TB patients tested for HIV in the different quarters. As you can see, in the recent quarter, it's only 26% of TB patients who were tested for HIV. And this also shows you the percentage of HIV patients screened for TB. As you can see, the current figure is low. It's 21%, only 21%. So I will talk about the problem in monitoring and evaluation of the different activities of TB HIV activities when I am discussing about the challenges of implementation. And this is also shows you the co-infection rate in the different quarters, and the average being 26%. And out of the TB HIV co-infected patients, it's only 30 to 65% who are started on ART, and the CPT coverage is 60 to 90% of all TB HIV co-infected patients, and IPT is given only for 2 to 80% of TB HIV patients who are supposed to be eligible for IPT. So when we come to the challenge, the major challenge for the implementation of TB HIV activities is human resource, both shortage and attrition, as a result of which there will be the existing staff are overloaded, and there is also lack of appropriately trained staffs for the implementation of TB HIV collaborative activity. And there is also a weak collaboration between TB and HIV programs, both at the program and facility level, especially below the regions, at the regional level and below. And in addition to lack of appropriate training, there is also inadequate and inconsistent supportive supervision and mentoring of the existing health workers. There is also poor integration of HIV components in the TB patient monitoring tools and HIV, TB-related information, TB ART, related information in the HIV patient monitoring tools. Now this has been updated, and probably this is going to be the reporting and recording and reporting might be solved after the updated formats are distributed. And there is also lack of responsible person for handling TB HIV data. And there is also poor linkage and referral among the different HIV and TB-related services. And HIV prevention activity is not actually integrated in TB clinics. There is no condom promotion, HIV preventive activities in the TB clinics. This is also very poor. And there is also poor TB infection control being implemented in the first-level facility. And there is also poor, as you have seen in the data also, there is a poor coverage of IPT and CPT. And this is due to inadequate and interrupted supplies of both CPT and IPT. And for CPT, CPT is highly associated with ART site expansion. So in those facilities where there is no ART, in those facilities where there is a TB clinic and HIV testing and counseling, free CPT is not available. So that is also one of the reasons for the low coverage of CPT. And there is also fear of resistance by the health workers and confidently ruling out active tuberculosis and initiating IND. This is also one of the reasons for poor IPT coverage. So although these are the challenges, there are also some opportunities for improving the quality of HIV-TB collaborative activity implementation. Starting from the last 2 years, there is a high government commitment for improving the TB services in general and TB-HIV activities in particular. And more implementing partners are coming together to work for the improvement of the implementation of TB HIV activities. This is demonstrated by their active involvement in the last year or two in the advisory committee, as well as their active involvement in the different technical working groups of the advisory committee. And testing and counseling is being scaled up, and it's going to be, the plan is to cover almost all public facilities to have testing and counseling. And similarly, there is also scale up of DOTS program to all government facilities. So this is a good opportunity also for expanding and improving the coverage of TB HIV activities. And there is also ongoing government initiative for improving capacity building. There is a human resource development plan which is being carried by the government. There is a plan an initiative called an accelerated health officer training program, which aims to train close to 5,000 mid-level health professionals within 3 years. So this can also will contribute for the improvement of general health service coverage, as well as TB-HIV collaborative activity. And the adaptation of integrated training and the government's initiative to integrate also the health management information system, which also improve some of the problems in related to reporting and data collection and reporting. And the existing also clinical mentoring, which is currently being supported by partners, but the government is now taking the lead in this clinical mentoring. This is particularly related to HIV services, but it can be used also for improving the quality of TB-HIV activities. And in the recent assessment, there are close to 406 sites which are implementing TB-HIV activities, which are benefiting from the existing clinical mentoring. So this is all my presentation. Thank you.
Any questions for Dr. Sirko?
Thank you for your presentation. Thank you for your presentation. Can you hear me?
Yes.
It is better. I'm from Myanmar, working at the Three Diseases Fund Management Office. We are funding the TB-HIV program as well as TB program, and from the range of the national program to the community-based NPP and all. Currently, you are presenting the program. Particular design for the public facility, isn't it, right?
Yeah.
Public facility. Is there any other involvement of the private sectors in the referral system or the kind of the linkage between the health facility level?
Yes, there is also involvement of the private sector, both in the ART scale-up as well as in the expansion of the DOTS program. So the 477 sites which are providing TB-HIV activities include also private facilities in addition to the public. I just mentioned only the challenges and opportunities that are available in the government sector. Otherwise, the activity is being implemented. Both HIV and DOTS program is being implemented in private sectors as well.
Any other comments, questions? Okay. Thank you. Our next speaker is my co-chair, Dr. Arusalam Negusi. She also comes to us from WHO, from the Department of Integrated Management of Adolescent and Adult Illness. And she's going to be talking to us about her experience at that level, and also tell us about some tools that are available to support TB-HIV collaboration.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I'm presenting on behalf of myself and Sandy Gove, who is also in the HIV/AIDS department I met. I will be talking about available tools and materials that support this decentralization of TB-HIV collaboration. with particular focus on materials available for health workers training and also ongoing learning. When we talk about decentralization, I think I would like to highlight this decentralization of service delivery and also program management. It's also essential that the program management is decentralized with service delivery. Otherwise, within the healthcare system, people at a national level, it will be difficult for them to support peripheral services unless program management is also decentralized to district team. And this is also the experience of several countries shows that currently there is rapid decentralization of HIV prevention care and treatment services to health centers in several settings. Why are we interested on decentralization? Decentralization supports equity, improves access to services, and also it has a positive contribution to adherence, because HIV care and treatment, as we know it today, is a lifelong care. Therefore, it's very important that it is closer to people. One, it supports access to care timely, which allows early diagnosis and also timely management of patients. And also once they are diagnosed and are put on care and treatment, if it is closer to their home, it can also improve or contribute for good adherence to care and treatment. And decentralization is also, in a way, it expands the capacity of the healthcare system and also requires preparing TB and HIV staff to provide both TB and HIV prevention care and treatment services, including ART. Therefore, when we decentralize services, in a way, we are also expanding the capacity of the healthcare system to cope with the demand created by TB and HIV. And these are some of the benefits of decentralization of HIV services for TB patients. As you know, in several countries, TB service is successfully decentralized to primary level care. But in several countries, ART or HIV care and treatment started from centralized tertiary level services. And it is very important that the decentralization of TB services also allows, or HIV services should also be decentralized to reach the majority of patients, TB patients who are accessing care and treatment at a primary level. These are some of the benefits. And also when we talk about decentralization of services and program management, it requires rebuilding the district network. This district network model is to allow also comprehensive care and also to ensure continuity of care and services. And also it allows facility and community interventions, which are closer most of the time. Health centers and primary level facilities are closer to the patient or to the community than hospitals and urban located big facilities. And also at a primary level, it also allows integrated services into existing primary level care services. It also requires building clinical teams and strengthen communication system with the district hospital or with the district support team. And also it also requires a very good patient monitoring system, which also is a backbone for ensuring quality of care. Why are we interested in integrated approach? In most setups, countries and programs, they can have a national separate HIV counseling and testing, PMTCT, STI, whatever programs. But when we go to the district and the peripheral facilities, most of the time the same person is responsible for all programs. And this is partly because of the lack of human resource, both at the facility and also program management level. Therefore, integrating programs makes much sense because of these reasons. And coming to the different tools that are available within WHO to support decentralization and integrated services, the different WHO tools and guidelines are based on WHO's normative technical guidelines and recommendations. And it's often based on evidences, and also when evidence are not available, based on expert, global expert consensus. These guidelines are developed, they are six, they are developed to support decentralization. They are simplified, standardized, and operationalized guidelines, which is very important when we decentralize services. At the periphery and primary level, most of the time, the health workers are generalists. They are responsible for multiple tasks. They often rotate among different services. Therefore, it is very important to standardize it, simplify it, and make it operational for that level. And it is developed to serve both as a learning or training material and also quick reference as a job aid in clinical setups. And the training materials, all the different guideline modules we saw, they have training materials, participant and facilitator guides. This is the harmonized modular short training courses to support scale up. Most of the time, the training is 2 weeks, a 1 week training of chronic HIV care with ART and prevention, which also includes patient monitoring and supply management as it relates to the clinical teams. It focuses only on the role of the clinical team in terms of recording and registering and also patient monitoring. Week two is followed by a short acute care course, provider-initiated testing and counseling, and also the different follow-on short courses depending on the responsibility of cadre of health workers. For instance, within those who work in TB clinic, one might choose to train them on TB HIV co-management, or on people who work in antenatal care services, one might opt to train them on PMTCT. This could be a follow-on training of 2 weeks, or sometimes in some countries they organize it on a block training. They do the first basic training, and then after some time they call them back for subsequent trainings. Decentralization has also its own challenges. One of the bigger challenges related to human resource, and the different WHO, IMA, and IMCI tools are developed to also support task shifting within the team and also from one team to another team. And also it allows and recommends people living with HIV to be part of the clinical team as paid member of the clinical team. And also clinical mentoring should also support ongoing learning, because the short-term clinical training by itself might not equip them to manage complicated cases. This is just to illustrate the different task shifting that has the tools support. These are from specialized doctors to general practitioners or medical officers, and from medical doctors and medical officers to health officers, and also to nurses. Within nurses, this task shifting within the clinical team can also happen to another clinical team. Some of the tasks from the HIV clinic or ART clinic can also be shifted to the maternal and child aid services, and also to the TB clinic. Like TB HIV co-management can be shifted to the TB clinic, and also managing pregnancy and HIV can also be shifted to the MCH clinic. And these are also the other lower level cadres in the clinical team who can take on some of the responsibilities. And this is also within the healthcare system. the different tools also apply at different level. The district hospital, health centers, and also community level. There are different tools that are relevant to the community, to the health center, and also to the district facility. And in terms of as response to the human resource challenges, effective training and strong follow-up after training are important. This is one of the lessons we've learned. Clinical mentoring should be part of the training and also part of the plan to train should also be follow-on training and clinical mentoring and also supportive supervision should be part of the initial planning for training. And this is just to simply highlight the importance of training and hiring people living with HIV to be expert patient trainers and also join clinical team as lay providers. And the recommendation is they should be paid member of the clinical team if they join the clinical team. And the other tool, the other challenge and also available tool is that management and when we decentralize services, management and logistic support also becomes a challenge to the healthcare system. And we have an operational manual which is developed in collaboration with several partners. And this operational manual is relevant in terms of assisting primary level care providers in terms of what infrastructure, supply management, lab, integration, linkage, and so on are important in order to decentralize the service to primary level. And as part of this, there are also it's also important in decentralizing the services to build the capacity of the district management team. And in order to do that, we have also tools related to district management. These are training course for HIV coordinators at a district level, and also manual is under development for district HIV managers, and also quality assurance tools are also important part of decentralization to the periphery. And the other area of challenge in decentralizing services is quality of care, which is also included in operations manual. And quality can be affected by several factors, including by leadership, presence of adequate infrastructure, appropriate training, and also available resources. And these are also included in the operations manual. There are some recommendations and so on for countries to adapt them to the different context. The other area directly related to quality of care is patient monitoring tools, which also generates the data to see program or service performance, acceptance, and so on. Therefore, we have, within WHO, we just developed a 3 interlinked patient monitoring system, which is an interlink between HIV care, ART patient monitoring system, PIMT-CT patient monitoring system, and also TB patient monitoring system, which also includes HIV variable within existing TB monitoring system. Therefore, this is also an important part of decentralization. Having a very strong patient monitoring system are also important. These are the different registers, records, and reporting materials that are available within the HIV care in the RT, MCH, and PMTCT, and also TB HIV. And within MCH and PMTCT, the PMTCT variables are incorporated into routine existing maternal and child health registers and records. If you are interested to have the different tools, some of them you can download them from WHO website, or you can also send us an email and then we can respond to your queries, comments, and so on. Thank you.
Any questions or comments for Dr. Ngozi? You please use the microphone because this is being webcast. So,
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm Ruth Akalola from UN World Food Programme Kenya. I work in the HIV and AIDS unit. My question to Jerusalem will be about the one-stop shop, because in Kenya, we are actually battling about the concept of one shop stop because of the one issue about the clients mixing, because some are with active TB and so forth. So we would like, my question or my concern would be, how do we go about it, because it's delaying us from having such an initiative which you are recommending now. Thank you.
Shall I respond?
Sure.
I think when we look at things from the patient perspective, like reducing waiting time and also reducing the hassle between going from one clinic to another clinic, one-stop shopping has benefit. But it also requires having a good TB infection control activity, with not only a plan, but something that should be implemented at a facility level. And the other thing is, most of the time, when we talk about TB infection control, we often focus on the TB clinic, HIV clinic, but I would like also to emphasize that within the outpatient department, there is a lot of TB infection control that needs to be implemented, because that's where you see patients who are not yet diagnosed, who are not yet on care and treatment, both including the outpatient department and also the lab services. Therefore, whether we have a one-stop service or a different clinic, I think having a strong TB infection control activity at a facility level is important. For instance, in several settings where outpatient clients just sit down in a very dark, poorly ventilated to not ventilated waiting area, you have an HIV-positive patient who's not yet diagnosed. You have a TB patient who's not yet diagnosed waiting there. Therefore, I think it has to be part of the day-to-day activity at a facility level, whether we have it at under one roof or not. And the recommendation should be to, as far as possible, to make it a one-place service and also have a strong TB infection control activity at a facility level.
My name is Rose Okocho, and I work with the union. I just wanted to know any update in regard to the tools to capture TB-HIV indicators from the HIV side. Based on what you had put up on one of your slides, you said pre-ART and ART registers. I don't know whether there's been any new information in regard to how much information we can collect. And if not, what would you recommend? Because many of us were working in projects, and the TB and HIV indicators from the HIV side are quite hard to get. So what would you suggest?
We as part of the development of a three interlinked system, the existing pre-ART, ART, and also the HIV care ART card has been updated to also include TB. Probably Sandy might have something to say with that.
Treatment,
that's actually been simplified by saying that instead of the exact date of start and stop for treatment, you put just a month and a year. So you can take out of the ART register if in the last year were they on TB treatment, and then you can put that over the total people that are on ART to get that very important indicator. And then the INH, and CSI's going to correct me if I'm wrong on any of these things, but INH is also by month and year started, so you can go into the pre-ART register and a modification was made so you know if someone is currently in care, and you can then do that calculation. So you can make sure you have the proportion of patients on INH in pre-ART, and they also wanted to get it out of the ART register so that the full range of the HIV variables for the indicators that come out of the TB, HIV indicators that come out of the HIV system have been agreed with the TB program. Where in the final review, there was actually a review copy of the whole forms booklet that was put on the website, but if you're interested in looking at the updated one, you get CSI's email because he's responsible for the final comments and the final finalization of this. We're also doing a big effort to have a protocol that goes out on an annual basis and gets the ART cohort data, the card source, gets some of the other more detailed, like we have the correct ART regimen and TB patient. We have the correct regimen and infection patient. And it can also then support all these tabulations from the pre-ART and ART register and from the cohort data. So I think that this is all in response to the modified MGAS indicator and all the other agreed indicators between WHO and HEPFAR and UNAIDS. And it's all a little bit changing, but I think it's really, on the TB side, pretty set what the indicators are, and I think we had a quite set agreement as to how we're going to measure those. And the only thing I think that's in flux is how do we actually do this annual patient monitoring review and get all the programs to cooperate so we can get them out. But CSI actually maybe even has a copy of it that you could look at the current one with concern.
Are there questions or comments? Yep, please. Again, please, if you don't mind using the microphone. Cause.
Yes, thank you for your presentation. And the question I'm about to ask may be obvious to many of you, but it goes back to this one-shop thing. And I was, as far as I've understood, a TB patient that has been diagnosed and put on treatment, it doesn't take very long before that person is not infectious anymore. And could it then not be that after that short period that he or she could be referred to the ARV clinic so that in reality there would be one stop? So that you could have the initial phase where you separate them, and then after the TB is not infectious anymore, then they go for one.
I would like to throw back the question for experiences. But I would like to emphasize again that within our facilities, TB and HIV patients are everywhere. It's not only in the TB clinic or in the HIV clinic.
I mean, I think it's a logical thought process, assuming that people are on, have susceptible TB to the drugs that they're on, they should convert their smears and become less contagious at least. Within a few weeks or month of starting therapy, so I think it's one of many potential ways that you could sort of conceive of to work it within a facility.
It is one of the potentials, and also we have newly diagnosed TB patients in the HIV care clinic. Also, one of the recommendations is to do assessment of HIV patients whenever they come for follow-up. Therefore, that's also an area where newly diagnosed TB patients are identified within the HIV care clinic. Even if we recommend that people who are going to the HIV care clinic will be those after the end of the infectious disease. We will always have new patients who are just diagnosed.
I was going to talk a little bit experientially about that, and you'll see some of it in our I'm the next presenter for this, but you know, I work at a couple of different sites within Kenya, and one of the other sites that I'm not going to describe today actually took the sort of the position that you're suggesting, but took it one step further, and that's at one of the district hospitals, not in the section that I'm going to be talking about later on. But they actually built their ART clinic next door to the TB clinic. So physically, they really aren't but about 10 feet apart. And what they did is actually, if you're in the, once you're diagnosed with TB, you're in the TB clinic, and you actually, they trained their TB clinical services to actually start ART. And so all the TB patients get their ART at the TB clinic until they finish their TB meds, and then they actually go back over really 5 feet away, or a little bit farther than that, to the ART clinic. And so I think that probably the concept is good, but the real issue is always in whatever situation you're in, how to get that one patient access to the two things they need, which is TB services and ART services as soon as possible.
Why don't we move on? Thank you. So we're now shifting and moving to Kenya. And our next speaker is Dr. Jane Carter, who almost just introduced herself. But she is the TB HIV Technical Advisor for the USAID AMPATH program in Eldoret, Kenya. And she's going to be sharing with us the progress that that program has made in Western Kenya.
Except that now I'm worried I broke the machine. Watching in your session the other day, I thought I wasn't supposed to click more than once. Oh, I see the technical person's running this way. She knew I was not as facile as I should be. Sorry, I only clicked once. Oh, thank you. It was that special click from IT. Want to thank the union for letting me come to actually talk about our experiences in Eldoret, Kenya, in really trying to design a TB HIV care system that ties care delivery together. But to really tell you about what we've done is I want to first take you back to the situation in 2001. In Kenya at that time, the TB incidence was reported to WHO to be about 213 per 100,000 smear-positive cases, and HIV incidence really varied from 9 to as high as 25% incidence in prenatal clinics dependent upon the region. At about this time, we worked to establish AMPATH, which stands for the Academic Model for the Prevention and Treatment of HIV/AIDS. And the background really is that this is actually a collaboration of Moi University School of Medicine, Moi Teaching and Referral Hospital, and what was called the Asante Consortium. The Asante Consortium is a consortium of five U.S. medical schools that had actually been partnering with the medical school at Moi since 1990 for medical education and care. And so the HIV program actually grew out of that collaboration. This is actually our catchment area. It was November of 2001 that the first AMPATH HIV care clinic opened at Eldoret, which is the site of the Moi Teaching and Referral Hospital and the medical school. Since that time, we've grown to 18 main clinics, 8 satellite clinics, and presently are caring for over 75,000 patients living with HIV/AIDS, with about an enrollment of 2,000 new patients a month. 50% on ART. You'll hear more about this from Dr. Camayo in the next talk, but we aim to have a comprehensive program that actually addresses things not just ART, but moving to food equity, microeconomics, and comprehensive TB HIV care, which is what this group, this program grew out of. But I think first to know where you want to go to make solutions, you actually have to begin to think about the problems. And so the problems that in terms we were facing in terms of the TB care is that community transmission affects all. HIV-negative infectious patients transmit to HIV-positive patients in the community, so that whatever system we're actually trying to build needs to address all TB patients, whether they're co-infected or not. HIV-related TB presents more commonly with smear-negative disease. Again, another problem if you're basing most of our active case finding on smear diagnostics. The standard country guidelines don't always address the specific issues of TB-HIV co-infection. And the example that I like to talk about is that in the national guidelines for TB control in Kenya, a TB patient who develops hepatitis while on their medications, the recommendation is to stop TB meds. In our co-infected patients, that actually leaves them at tremendous risk, and we really may not have the time to just allow them to be off medicines and recovering. And then TB drug resistance has implications for both HIV negative and HIV positive patients. It's that the effect on HIV positive patients is much more immediate. With that, a little bit of a background, I think, you know, at times, I think we would all want to pack up our bags and just run away because it seems like it's just such a hard and large group of problems to tackle. So what we actually tried to do was to say, okay, let's take one thing at a time. In our co-infection program, the first thing that we decided to work on was intensified case finding. We need to stop that transmission that's going on into the community, and in fact, what I like to say is that's community TB infection control. So we put together a collaborative project, and in fact, we're very lucky to do this at the time of the Fidelis projects from the Union, which is the fund for innovative DOTS expansion through local initiatives. We decided to try a cough monitor model, which was a lay individual from the communities in which they lived that ringed our HIV clinics. They're trained in community sensitization regarding TB. They use a cough questionnaire that was developed in the late 1980s and early 1990s in Kenya to screen suspects, and they do sputum collection. We have a hospital-based program that sweeps through the referral hospital every day to screen every new admission, and then the larger part of our work is actually field-based. This was, as I said, initiated in 2004. We found the funding through the Round 3 Fidelis project. I'm going to let you know up front that, in fact, we've actually had that program going since that original funding in 2004, first through a second Fidelis project and now through our USAID AMPATH partnership funding, that's PEPFAR, and Global Fund money. The original design was the cough questionnaire just screened symptomatics in the community. We also did some smear diagnostics labs strengthening by retraining lab technicians, but also infrastructure support such as simple microscope repair in many of our peripheral clinics. This is not, none of these programs are static. We actually keep morphing them to try to actually do a better and better job. So the first modification to the cough monitor model was to include case holding. So the cough monitors become responsible not only for the screening that patient initially, but if a patient in the community is smear positive, they help to case hold by being sure that the sputum is collected at month 2, 5, and 8 in follow-up. The newest rendition of the cough monitor model is that now our cough monitors are actually going into the home of each of the smear positives to do case finding there with the same cough questionnaire. Well, how did that do? In round 3, we concentrated on UG District, which is the district in which the Moy Teaching and Referral Hospital and the main AMPATH program is situated. And in 1 year, we screened over 16,000 individuals with a cough questionnaire and came up with about 1,657 smear-positive cases, with a cure rate of 90%, meaning that we collected that smear at the end of therapy. In round five, we actually expanded to North Rift and Western provinces, and in 1 year screened over 42,000 people who were symptomatic with this model, using about, I think it was at the most, 155 cough monitors in the field, and identified 4,132 smear-positive cases. The ongoing program, just to give you an idea in a quarter, in the second quarter of 2008, we now have 97 cough monitors spread in the field. We've grown, we've moved back. We're trying to find the right number of screening individuals to our populations, but we screened about 2,300 cases, symptomatic individuals coming up with about 400 cases. So it's been an ongoing project of intensified case finding in our catchment area in Western Kenya for about 5 years. Well, that was the first thing that we wanted to work on, was that whole issue of community transmission. In 2005, the Kenya AIDS Control Program adopted diagnostic testing and counseling. We immediately adopted that into all of the into the TB clinic at Moy Teaching and Referral first, but then into the TB clinics in our catchment area for our HIV program, and made this available, an immediate referral to the AMPATH HIV care program for all of our positive patients. It turned out that about 67% of all of the patients registered in the TB clinic were HIV positive. So, in fact, this became a case finding for our HIV care program. I think it's also interesting to just go back and revisit the biggest barrier for when we wanted to start to do this was actually resistance by the healthcare staff, who initially thought that the patients were not ready for routine HIV testing. In fact, very few patients refused in those initial months, and now that's standard. The next issue became that our TB HIV care protocols. I gave you that example of the issue within the national guidelines that, in fact, a TB patient who develops hepatitis on their TB medicines, we'd stop their TB medicines until they recovered from their hepatitis. What we did started looking at within our TB HIV care program, because in fact all of our TB care is now actually given at the HIV care sites, was to try to address those types of issues that come up once you start to move the care for the patients together in one site. Because some of the care protocols were beginning to differ slightly from the national TB guidelines, we actually, as we have done with all of our work, partnered with the DLTLD, the TB Control Program, to ask their opinion about our guidelines, to get their buy-in for our guidelines. And in fact, when we trained the 160, 180 caregivers within AMPATH on the TB HIV guidelines, the DLTLD head of the national program came and opened our training symposium that day, and the provincial leprosy and TB control officer helped teach our guidelines and, in fact, stood up whenever people would say that's not a national guideline. He was the person in the audience to stand up and address why we needed to deviate in these instances from national guidelines. So we put in our training program. And these are just the type of algorithms that we made. This is actually the adoption of the WHO evaluation for smear-negative HIV-positive patients in the ambulatory setting. And this is the type of algorithm for our co-infected pregnant patients, although this is an old guideline that needs to be updated. At the time that we started the AMPATH HIV care program, a conscious decision was made to include IPT in that program. And so our present protocol is that at enrollment, HIV patients have a chest radiograph, a history, and a physical exam. If all of those are normal, IPT is given for 9 months. And our results of that first cohort was presented at IAS in August of this year. It's the first, it's a three-year time period between 2004 and 2007. We couldn't quite capture some of our early work between 2001 when the clinics opened and 2004 because of a database problem. But IPT was initiated in about a third of our patients. The evaluation looked for the presentation at IAS looked at endpoints of completion of that 9 months versus premature completion, termination, and you can see about 76% of patients are able to complete within our care program. Of the non-completers, we didn't have a lot of incident TB during therapy, but about 3% of the population, and 4% of the population developed active TB after INH termination. We're actually beginning to try to look at those subsets to actually see how those diagnoses were made. This is just a graph of the proportions of completers of INH are at the top, the non-completers are at the bottom, and the proportion of who developed TB along the way. Well, one of the other problems that I mentioned that we talked about early on was actually the whole issue of smear-negative tuberculosis. We were able in 2005 to actually capture the attention of FIND and be able to be a site for a demonstration project for the development of a mycobacteriology lab. The MOU was, again, between all of our stakeholders, FIND, the hospital, Medical School, and AMPATH, with an agreement for our smear reagents to all come from the DLTLD. So, in fact, again, what we've been trying to do all along is include all of the stakeholders. So just to give you an example of how it's all divided, one technician comes from the teaching hospital and is seconded into the MRL. Three of the technicians are paid through AMPATH PEPFAR money, and then the equipment and reagents came from FIND. What we did is we established that all smear-negative specimens receive one free culture. This is, unfortunately, we've not been able yet to extend this throughout our entire catchment area. This is primarily at the teaching hospital, but it gives you some ideas of the number of cultures that we're doing each month. About 10 to 12% are culture positive. So again, these are additional diagnoses beyond our smear microscopy. Well, what about the issues of drug resistance? Retreatment and failure patients are eligible for a free drug susceptibility test at the Central Reference Laboratory in Nairobi. The protocols throughout Western Kenya were that the chest clinics packaged and sent those specimens directly to the CRL. Well, one problem that actually became clear is that chest clinics were not used to actually tracking specimens and actually had no specific system for reporting. So that, in fact, when we would go to the chest clinics within our encatchment and ask, you know, what do you do with the results from the CRL, most of the time people would pull open a drawer and say, well, here they all are, I got them all, but because these were fully susceptible or no growth, we didn't think we needed to act on them. And so they went in the drawer because they weren't deemed to be a problem. Well, here we were in the middle of the AMPATH encatchment area with our AMPATH or HIV care cars traveling daily to all of our HIV clinics, taking drugs, our food equity program, and bringing labs back to the central hospital where our CRL was. So we actually decided just to build upon that logistics system. We started a retreatment program where any specimen could just be placed on that AMPATH car that was coming back to our central hospital where our central reference laboratory was. All specimens are now accessioned and tracked by the MRL so that if a specimen is not back from the Nairobi central lab within 8 weeks, it precipitates a phone call to check on that. Any drug resistance that comes back through the MRL, instead of just waiting for the paperwork to go back to the clinic, that's also called to the clinician so that a more immediate response can be made. We went out and retrained every site with verification that they had all of the necessary materials. And so now what we're doing is we're averaging about 30 specimens a month in terms of a retreatment surveillance program. Well, obviously, when you start looking for a problem out there, you'll find it. And in fact, what we started seeing was a few diagnoses of multi-drug resistant TB cases in our AMPATH and catchment area. In the fall of last year, we actually decided to go out and try contact tracing of those first three patients to actually get an idea of what kind of community impact this might be making. And I think it was really the power of one of the patients that we actually contact traced that convinced us to try to move on and try to solve the problem of developing a treatment program. One of the patients had died prior to any therapy being started because, in fact, we didn't have any second-line therapy in Western Kenya at the time. Turned out he was a school teacher in an elementary school, and over 50 children were exposed to him in the last 6 months of life, during which time he was working and noted to be smear positive throughout. His wife, who was a nurse, had already moved to Nairobi to take a new job prior to any screening done. So it was really that information that sort of pushed us to try to develop a community-based DOTS Plus program. The DLTLD had been focusing all of their efforts at that time on an inpatient model of care that would be centered at Nairobi. We really had no inpatient safe facility in Eldoret. We have no ability to segregate our contagious patients, much less an identified MDR patient. And so we designed a Community DOTS Plus program. We were able to contact Lilly and be given capreomycin on a compassionate need basis through their MDR program, and we're moving forward to put in our own green light committee application for a small number of patients when, in fact, the oral drugs were donated to us by the DLTLD. Philanthropic funds have actually staffed, have supplied the money for our community-based outreach workers to do the directly observed therapy while we're pending an agreement between the DLTLD and our stakeholders locally. What's happened with that problem program so far? Well, since March, when we started the treatment for our first patient, we've identified 10 MDR patients in our encatchment program area. Two died before therapy. One has finished induction with sputum culture conversion. We have one pregnant woman, one child, and 60% of our MDR patients are HIV infected. Well, what I've tried to actually take you through in about 10 to 15 minutes, the path that we've really taken over the last 5 years in trying to build the program. And I think what we want to actually leave as a message is that TB-HIV integration is quite feasible, but that one of the critical factors is actually communication between all of the programs. Sometimes you can say, oh, gosh, it takes us so much time to actually get all the stakeholders together or to go about and do all the reporting of all the stakeholders. But, in fact, the time spent has been invaluable because, in fact, by communicating between all of the stakeholders, which now are the academic institutions, the DLTLD, and our HIV care program, we've been able to find opportunities where we could get a different grant, a different possibility for funding stream to build this. Just to let you know, I think it always sounds like these type of programs needs millions and millions of dollars, and we would actually love to have millions and millions of dollars, but the top funding for one calendar year for this program has been about $180,000 U.S., and most of the time our funding has been capped at about $150,000. So I think you can see that we've been able to try to build a great deal without huge influx of money, although, again, I say anybody has big money, we'd be happy to see it. The next conclusion is that programs can be built in a stepwise fashion. I think that we often look at the magnitude of the problem and say, well, gosh, that's too big. I don't know how to tackle it. But that the real issue is really biting off small bits of this and getting started. And so, in fact, one of my chairmen and one of my mentors has always said to me, the perfect should not be the enemy of the good. We couldn't build a perfect program when we all started talking about our TB-HIV integration in 2001, but we thought we could start with at least a good program and build from there. But if we say the perfect should never be the enemy of the good, we should never say that we'll settle for good. We should keep moving toward the perfect TB-HIV integrated program. I'd like to just acknowledge all of our funders over the years. And, in fact, this is a work of a great number of people, but specifically I'd like to actually highlight our 190 cough monitors who work in the field and actually try to do what is our at least community-based infection control to make our communities a little bit safer. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions or comments for Dr. Carter?
It's the end of the conference, and my husband would say I always talk a lot anyway. Thank you.
Thank you. Our final speaker for this symposium is Dr. Sylvester Camayo. He is the director of the USAID AMPATH Partnership in Eldoret, Kenya. So he's the director of the AMPATH program.
Good afternoon. Jen has made work a little easier for me in that she has introduced AMPATH first and introduced a few things about our collaboration. I will not repeat a lot of those introductions, but just pass through them. And my topic is home-based testing for HIV-TB, and is this the way to get ahead of the epidemic? That's AMPATH, which has been ably introduced by Jen, and those are the partners in this program, and those are the schools in the U.S. that work with us, and those are our funders. I think the main one has been the USAID, and hence we have partnered as the USAID AMPATH partnership. But just to show that there are many others who participate in supporting AMPATH, including, of course, and starting with the Ministry of Health of Kenya and its various departments, as well as several others who take care of these patients, particularly in our door-to-door enterprise when they get positive and they are taken care of. I would like to just stress also one small family foundation, the PVF Foundation of Canada, which actually funded our initial door-to-door pilot, as well as the Abbott Fund for giving us all the determined kits, test kits we needed, as well as the logistics around all the test kits, including the ones we got from the government. And the rest of those are the people who support us. Jen has already alluded to the 18 clinics we run in the Western Kenya region, and that has been our growth curve. And the big change in that curve was when USAID PEFA, you know, came to our aid. Now, but we have challenges, and really I'm just dwelling on the need for the door-to-door testing. As we have shown, and Jen has also said, we take care of about 75,000 patients currently. And we have 18 clinics and about 14 sub-clinics. We add about 2,000 patients every month. We have excellence in adherence and retention, as well as cutting-edge programs. Jen just showed your TB-HIV collaboration. But we also have others, income security, food security, with a lot of support from the World Food Program, PMTCT, psychosocial support, community mobilization, oncology, and others. But we think we are actually losing the battle. less than 15% of persons in areas we serve know their HIV status, and I think this is like any other sub-Saharan Africa country. And patients present far too late and far too sick. As shown by one of my patients here, Musa, presented like that. And we were just lucky with all the achievements and activities, we just converted him to that. But that was lucky. We had a lady this time presented to us nearly death. And again, with a lot of hard work and all the programs we have, we managed to make her look like this and still lives on. This other lady was not so lucky. She died. We did all the best we could, but she died. While this other gentleman also died, despite trying all the best we could in an academic medical center, we couldn't save him. So we have a problem. Despite all the support and the PEPFAR support we have, we are catching them too late, so there needed to be something to be done beyond this. In one of our clinics near Lake Victoria, Hunyangu, greater than 70% of the married women we received presented to us as widows, and that fact alone hastens poverty, hunger, OVCs. And so what exactly is missing? And we cannot really treat our way out of this crisis. And there is, and this is time for a new idea, which we tried. Now, in our country, we have very efficient VCT services that have been on, available, and doing great work. Many people get tested. And soon, when it changed to the clinical setting and came in DTC, we tested even more. And we thought we were doing very well. And then we needed everybody to test, every healthcare work to test. And this, again, had a lot of government support, and we think we are winning. But still, this is not enough. In September of 2006, AMPATH has actually been discussing the possibility of universal HIV testing in a defined catchment area. And just at that time, the ideas came from Bushenyi district in Uganda. And CDC had sponsored testing of a whole district in Bushenyi. And they tested 281,000 people in their homes. And greater than 79% accepted testing, with 30,000 couples tested together. And imagine, 63% of the couples were discordant. Just imagine that. So we took and read and looked at all this and got their notes. They had not published anything. And we came up with several 8 priests that drove us to going forward. We actually thought we could get a free patient. If we tested them before they became sick, we had a free patient. And following that, with the discordance I just showed you, free concordance, we go to the free widow, free PMTCT, free OVC. If they hadn't died, the parents had not died, we didn't wear the OVCs. Free poverty and free hunger, or at least less than we would get with full-blown disease, like I showed with Musa. And of course, very, very important, pre-TB. And the overall thing is prevention. So we had, armed with this, we set forward to do our first pilot. And this is, we first trained community people, village people, to be our John the Baptist, or the community mobilizers, to prepare the way for the counselors. So right here, one This gentleman here is our staff. He's a community mobilizer. He comes from the village where we were moving in next. And this is the family or the household they are talking to or preparing them. And the questions they eventually ask them is, are you willing to accept a counselor to come to your home? They did not ask them, are you willing to be tested? They said, are you willing for a counselor to come into your home? And then once we trained these people, we brought our counselors who are accredited to the national program in terms of they were certified, experienced, and we initially used mainly nurse counselors who are very experienced because we were doing it for the first time in our area. So we brought them together just to get used to each other and to form teams and then go out to the community to start doing the testing. And in terms of community entry, we had to do a lot of innovation, including running, long-distance running, in this tug of war, all sorts of things, a whole day of activities to try to go into the community. And we did this several times as a preparation to all this before we then moved into the community. Sometimes there were a lot of challenges, and occasionally we did a lot of this as we went into the villages. And the gentleman in the center, actually, as soon as we managed to push the car, fell flat on the mud, but still joined us to go along. Now, so for the HIV part, our counselors moved into their homes 2 days after the mobilization activities had been done. And they used two rapid tests parallel as by the national protocols in Kenya. And those who tested positive within their homes were referred to our clinics. And those who tested negative were reinforced on the risk reduction behaviors. We also did a few other things apart from HIV. We did TB screening. We first used the screening questionnaire. And then those who were positive for the screening questionnaire, we did sputum collection and brought them to our clinics for processing. We also tried to tackle malaria by distributing mosquito nets. And we gave deworming to children because of they have a lot of worms. So this was just trying to improve the health of the houses or the households that allowed us in. Now, just the results of the first site that we did, the pilot site that we did in August to November of 2007, we first did a focus group discussion to find out what is the best way, who are the best people to go into the homes. And one of the things they told us is, if it is counselors, please don't bring the counselors from our own village. Bring them from very far who don't know us. And they actually agreed that we needed to have own people to be the people leading the way. And they suggested to us that when the counselors come into the home, please, the community mobilizer should leave very fast. We don't want them anywhere near the home during the time of the process of actually counseling and testing. Now, the census we did for the division, the area I'm representing is a division. There are several divisions that make one district. So we were in one division. And the census showed us that we had about 6,000 people living in that division. And the majority of the households accepted our counselors into the home. In this particular first pilot, only 13 households did not let us in at the first pass. Now, we used eligibility criteria to decide on the testing in the home. All the adults tested if they accepted, while anybody above the age of 13, we tested if they accepted testing. Children below 13, we only tested if the mother was dead of an unknown cause or if the mother was HIV positive. So we didn't routinely test all the children. We needed just, they fitted into that criteria. So of the 36,000 people, 20,000 were eligible for testing, while 19,000 accepted counseling by our counselors, and 18,000 did test. That's about 91% of the people, the eligible people. And in that area where we started, we actually chose an area we had been there for a long time to learn. And the prevalence in this particular area was low. And we actually found that it was, of the 20,000 people, 439 were HIV positive. Just 2.4%. That's low. In what Jen showed you is that some of our populations around Lake Victoria can go up to 25%. We didn't want to start there. We wanted to start in a lower prevalence area as a learning before we move to the rest of the areas. We also realized that 4,451 had already tested before. We had been running this program in these regions for about 6 years. And of those who were tested, about 156 were positive. And we traced where these were. Majority of them were actually in our own clinics, while some were either attending care elsewhere or we didn't know where they were going. Now, I just showed you the first site, which is Mosoria. That was our pilot site. We were funded by the PVF Family Foundation of Canada. We are currently three-quarters of the way in doing another site, Tarbo, which is shown in red. And we also are going to launch just in November to test 2 million people within our 18 catchment areas. And we are going to be funded and by the Global Business Coalition. They have already raised half the money, and PEFA will match it dollar for dollar. So for our next site, which has a census of about 120,000 people, we have already approached 80,000, and we have already tested 48,000. I don't have the results of the HIV test. And we have already distributed in that particular site 26,000 mosquito nets as part of our improving the health of that particular location. I think it's also worth mentioning that we have distributed 10,000 doses of albendazole for deworming the children. And in the previous site, we had given 9,000 mosquito nets distributed. Some of the things we found in this region is that whom do you give? We're only giving two per household. And those we initially wanted to give one, but we found it strange. Who uses it? Is it the husband or the wife? And we just actually realized they sleep on different beds. So giving one is a tug of war. So we started giving two. Now, this is the TB part. All patients were screened with a cough questionnaire, as I mentioned. And in the first site, 60 patients were screened with sputum for AFB. And one was smear positive. For the next site, 388 were screened for TB, head sputum collected, and five were positive. The cultures so far are all negative. We expect to culture more than we can do smears, but we had the other way around. We probably needed to do, and we are looking into the reason for this, why even the sputum smear was less. What Jen Carter presented with the cough monitors had a bigger catch. Here we were using our nurse counselors to take the first sputum and send the cough monitors to collect the second and the third. But we did not do so well in catching as much. Maybe Jen Carter's team had already finished all the TB in the village, but maybe we had problems in our nurses screening. Now, what we have learned very briefly is that it's feasible to do door-to-door testing in a rural setting. And we realize that community participation from the conceptualization to the implementation is very, very key. And we need support from key leaders in the community. We started with the district commissioner, the district officer, the chiefs, the village elders. We used all of them, the church elders, in moving into the community, and they gave us a lot of support. We also realize male involvement is very, very important. The person who gave permission to the entry of the home was the head of the household, the man. And it was very key that we won the men into giving us permission to enter into their homes. We also were using a bit of new technology. We are using our counselors who are carrying PDS and GPS for mapping, because we needed to be able to trace these homes using the GPS. And also, the political temperature at the time when we did our first one was, you know, what happened at the end of December and what happened. We tried to finish very quickly, and we actually, things happened in December 07 in Kenya and post-December. Now, the other thing, school children testing is an issue. They are at school. They need to give consent. We left out many of them, and we're trying to improve that, maybe going back during the school holidays. The mentally and physically disadvantaged, disclosure issues, rumors, misconceptions, alcohol, distance from one homestead to another sometimes can be challenging. For the TB part, we probably did not put a lot of emphasis to our counselors to the TB part. We were in meetings and in monitoring and evaluation. We looked mainly at the HIV part and forgot a little bit the TB part because Jen was not there. But when she came, we're trying to catch it up. Or really, the joke is that we did not do very well in TB for the emphasis we had, and we are trying to improve on that as well. And what we are currently doing is reapproaching the homes where they declined. Sometimes we have gone back to the home with the same counselor, and they now say, now you can test, while others have completely refused. You know, counseling, we realize, is ongoing and has to be repeated several times before final acceptability. And then, of course, there is the issue of surveillance. We hope to figure out how to do repeat testing for those who are HIV negative. We obviously cannot go door to door, but at least work out some randomization or some way of monitoring as a way of prevention. And then the discordant couples is so key that we catch them and follow them and give the prevention message and repeat testing. And then continuous monitoring for TB in the particular location. And then also we are extending our clinics into the community. We have people we have hired to stay in the particular location, one per 5,000, and we hope to use these people for PMTCT, for DOTS, for the outreach for missed appointments from our clinics, and as well as home assessments, social work, OVC, and so on. We hope to use these people we have hired, and we are continuing to hire as an extension of our clinics into the community. And actually, this is primary care. We are just transforming and even transforming our name from the academic model for the prevention and treatment of HIV/AIDS to the academic model providing access to health care, something like that. We're soon changing our name. Now, so what I really wanted to show you is door-to-door testing is visible, and it will facilitate early treatment and prevention. And for us, it's a way to get ahead of the HIV as well as the TB epidemics. because we get many people like this who thought they were HIV positive, and suddenly they realize they are negative, and they say, I'll never do it again. And they go, this particular gentleman went around the village showing his card that he was HIV negative. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Mayo. Questions, comments?
Congratulations. I think this model is useful for all the poor countries. I just want to know a few clarification related to the sputum test in the village. You mentioned that you have a social community mobilizer who are doing the counseling, and also for the sputum test, they are carrying back to the health facility. And then for the next day, the cough monitor also collect the sputum and then they send it back to the health facility. Is it true? And my question is how these community mobilizer and then the cough monitor, how they link, and then also do you appoint the cough monitor in every villages, and then also would you provide the transportation cost for all these the students transport to the health facility, and then what is the average, you know, the distance or the transportation time from the village to the health facility, nearest health facility. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We think the reason why we failed miserably with the TV part has to do with those kind of logistics. Our nurse counselors, the first phase, we just use nurse counselors. The second phase, we have changed a little bit and use a lot of lay counselors. And the reason we wanted to use nurse counselors, these were medical people. And when they went into the home, we expected them to judge and do the screening questions and then collect the sputum. And this sputum, unfortunately, they kept in their bags the first sample of sputum and brought it back with them in the evening. We had transport to the health center from the village to the health center where the sputum smear was being done, and eventually sputum cultures were being done. There was a dropout then because some of this sputum they carried the whole day. They arrived to the village at about 8, 9 o'clock in the morning in a bright African nice sunlight, and eventually in the evening brought that sample, transported back to the health center, and eventually back to our central laboratory for culture. The smear was done in the health center. There was obviously a problem there, and we think we're trying to improve on that. In terms of, I think the other question was, I missed the second question.
Second point is do you provide the transportation costs?
This is all taken care of. We have actually vehicles we hire from the village ready to transport the counselors. The community mobilizers are village people. We don't need to transport them anywhere. You know, we hire the ones who belong to the village where the community mobilization was done. And they are the ones who led the counselor to the homes. That home said, come. That home said, come. This one, don't enter into this one, and so on. So we didn't need to transport those.
It's for the next student specimen, how do you manage to get the student sample to the health center, facility?
Now, that we had the cough monitor, as well as the government has in Kenya a technician who has a motorbike to go to every home, and the ones that the council has collected the first sputum, collected from there and brought the specimen back. Those who are brought a little faster than the morning one, because their job the following day and the third day was to just collect sputums and bring them back to the health center.
So is there every...
The cough monitors all actually have bicycles.
Yes, this is the one that I would like to know. That's girl, or the, at least that we have to transport. You have to provide the transportation cost, and then the average distance from the health facility to the village from the village to the health facility. How long does it take? Like 1 day or the half day or like?
It's a well, our first site, a division. Mm-hmm. You know, it took about. The first have to go through every home, and that takes time. But let's say they have all the samples collected. They took between maximum of 1 hour to reach the health center. But you see, the logistics is that going from home to home may take a few hours.
Great. Thank you very much. It was a great presentation. I have two questions for you. The first of all, for a lot of these home-based counseling and testing or any kind of home-based testing, it's very difficult to get men because often they're not at home during the day. What kind of strategies did you use to make sure that men were a substantial portion of your sample? And then I guess number two is among the patients or among the people that you identified as HIV infected, how long did it take before they enrolled in the clinic, and did you need to go back to encourage patients to go in for care?
Thank you. You know, I did mention that the men was the key, and strategies to catch the men is what is important. And I think one of the things we used, you know, you send a man to catch another man. The chiefs, the village elders were mostly men. And these activities, the games, the so many things. And our community mobilizers also had a lot of men in them. And they actually went and booked an appointment on what day is most suitable, what time is most suitable. And then our counselors tried to go during the appointed time, the one they chose. But even then, we also put in a few things that we eventually had to change a little bit. We put some tent outside, outside the village for those. And what we found very, very interesting, our health centers, the village where we started, or the health centers, the regular health center, started getting flooded by men before the actual testing. And what we realized they were doing, they were actually testing beforehand, before they had the courage to go and test in front of their wives. That we found a fact. It was increased 400-fold as a way of testing before they actually came to the testing. But still, we have a problem. Our biggest problem is with the men, and we are trying whatever we can to convince the men to test. In fact, several times I followed the counselor to see what was going on, and what we found is the man runs through the front gate, and the wife runs through the behind gate sometimes, and we had to, you know, to use a lot of ways and patience to be able to do. But we tested 91% of the people. Most of them, of course, obviously, are women. But the men have to give consent for them.
As Christian Gunneberg from Stop TB, I'm just going to say something about the malaria side. I remember before I came to WHO, we were in Malawi, and we're doing a sort of household survey of who gets malaria, and it was children who had 80% parasitemia, and only 5% of those had symptoms. And that led us to believe that mosquito nets are best given to children, although I don't know if you can always do that politically in a family. But I was just wondering, is there also a scheme maybe for linking it to schools or you know, the distribution of nets, or is this the only way that nets are going into the community?
No, there are various ways of distributing nets in Kenya. At the moment, it has been in the antenatal clinics, the ones with the young children who are given subsidized nets to take to the home. But what we did, actually, we were targeting households with children, and we hoped that the children were the ones to use. only that we ended up finding there was an argument on who uses the net. Obviously, it should be the woman with the children, aimed at the children, but the exact analysis of how the nets were being used. There's also a lot of nets being distributed. Even when we went, there had been nets distribution through the government from PSI earlier. And the other question, just as we were coming, I was coming this way, there was a week where the nets were being retreated in the government health facilities with the various insecticides. And whether we have not gone back to analyze who is actually using the nets and are they actually using them.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kimaiyo, for that interesting and detailed presentation. Now that we've just had our Kenya AIDS Indicator Survey, and it is telling us something interesting about the older people from 60 years, 64 and above, and the percentage of those who are HIV positive is more than the children. Now, my question is, in your target groups that you showed us, did you see more of them coming forward, or did you target them in the village, or you're planning to?
You know, we tested everybody above the age of 13, and there were a few of the older people. You know, I didn't put it here in the analysis, but It didn't strike us as being the older people. It was the same kind of thing that we have been seeing in terms of the young adults rather than the older people. But we found a few old people who are HIV positive in the villages. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? To any of our panelists? If not, then I think we're finished. Thank you.